I'm going to talk a little bit about the past, but there's also a story that we missed, and I think it really gives us a good perspective of Delano back at that time. And that was a story about your brother, I don't know if your brother was a catcher, and one of the guys, one of the tractor drivers.
Oh, yeah. Played baseball together. Yeah.
I've been a pitcher, and so you told me about walking up to him and approaching him. Can you tell me the story?
Yeah.
So I think it really illustrates kind of racial dynamics, right?
It sure does. Oh, yeah. Okay. What that is, okay.
How are you on time?
We're fine. That's it. The San Joaquin Valley in the 1940s was the recipient of all these Okies, you know, came in the 30s. It's really, literally, Delano and Early Mart were the dead center of the Grapes of Wrath territory. This is where John Steinbeck came and to do his research. I didn't know that as a kid, you know. I didn't even know that when I read the Grapes of Wrath, but I found it out later. And the fact is that I knew in life that there were a lot of Okies because I went to school with a lot of Okies, and these were poor whites. And that was also one of the building blocks of my life. The fact that one of a very close friend of mine named Leon Fitch, you know, we went to grammar school together, lived in the next ranch over, and his family were like poor white trash, basically, lived in a longhouse. And there was Marvin and Curtis and Ernest and Lillian. I remember all their names. And the father and the mother. And I used to have dinner with them, and they used to eat cornbread and beans. And it seemed to me that this was poor people's food, you know, but it was different than mine. It was white, and yet it was not the growers, you know. It was something else. This is Okie, Southern slightly, you know, whatever, Okie. And the thing is that I knew them because I was going to a school. My brother and I were going to a school called Columbine. The oldest of my sisters also, we put her on the bus. She started school there as well. Columbine is a little country school between Early Mart and Delano, about 4 or 5 miles outside of Delano. And mostly growers' kids, which is interesting. Mostly growers' kids, but occasionally farm workers. And I know of a couple of Chicano poets that also went through there when they were kids going through. But when my brother and I went there, we were the only two Mexican kids in this school. And there were maybe 100 pupils. There were four classrooms, first and second, third and fourth, fifth and sixth, seventh and eighth. That was it. And many of the kids that were poor whites were Okies, as a matter of fact, at the school. And then there were Yugoslavs, Scandinavians, the Dulcich's, you know, George Dulcich. These guys, the Dulcich's, became growers. George Dulcich became one of the growers that was on strike. And he hated us with a passion. And yet, when I was a kid, we'd played volleyball. And my brother, my older brother Frank, was a baseball player, and he was also a catcher. And he had a friend called Floyd, who used to pitch. And they were a team, and they used to throw the ball. And when they went to high school, Delano High, they both joined the baseball team, and my brother was a catcher, and Floyd was the pitcher. And occasionally I'd do shortstop, you know, I'd play when we used to play games in the afternoons. And I know that my brother had a tremendous relationship with Floyd. They were great friends, and I was kind of the little brother. I used to hang around with him. And there was no sense of a racial distinction there, although we knew, Floyd knew we were Mexicans and we knew he was an Okie, but there was no discrimination, so to speak. So we graduated, well, my brother graduated from the 8th grade with Floyd, went to high school, and then eventually we moved north, and Floyd stayed in the San Joaquin Valley. We never saw him again. This is 1953. 12 years later, I'm back in Delano, you know, working with Caesar, and I've become an organizer. And then in 1966, we start doing the rounds. We start agitating for a union election, and we go out to the Sierra Vista Ranch, which was one of the ranches where my dad had worked. And they're gathering all of the crews out there at noon, and we used to go out there, and the Teamsters are also starting to come in. And so there's bitter competition during the lunch hour just to talk to the workers. All of the workers thought we were communists. They would gather on one side, the tractor drivers all dusty and trying to eat their lunches. And here come these communist, Mexican communist farm worker organizers talking to the Mexican campesinos and even going over and talking to the Okies from time to time. So I'm in there organizing, talking to the campesinos, and I look at all these dusty faces, you know, of these tractor drivers from the ranch. And among them, I spot a familiar face. In spite of the dust, in spite of the years, it's Floyd. Amazing. So I walk up to him, and I said, "Hi, Floyd." And he kind of took me aback, because he was this communist coming over to talk to you. And here are all these buddies of his, you know, looking at him. And he says, "How do you know my name?" And I said, "Because we went to school together, man. Don't you remember Columbine?" I said, "I'm Frank's brother. You remember me. You knew me as Louis." He says, "I'm Luis now, but you knew me as Louis." I saw the light, you know, yeah. I said, "You remember my brother?" "Yeah," he said. "He was a good boy. He was a good boy." And then he walked away. And he didn't want to talk to me. But for that moment, it was like a look of recognition. And that gap, that chasm that existed between us suddenly been closed, but he opened it up. There was no way that we would sit there and reminisce about the past. But he knew who I was, and I hope. And the thing is that he certainly recognized my brother's name. It was a name out of the past for him. But they had been tight. They had been a little team at one time. And that just reflects, again, what had happened. I have other experiences, you know, where I met people that I went to school with that were not growers, and they couldn't believe it was me. They drive up in their pickup trucks, you know. I ran into my grammar school principal, who started lecturing us on the picket line. And he says, "Don't you know what you're doing? You're bringing communism. This is America. You're destroying this. Don't you know what you're saying?" And I went up to him. I said, "Mr. Glover, do you know who I am?" I said, "I was your student. I went to your school for 7 years. And the reason I'm here is because of what my dad was going through in the fields. It's what I went through working out here. That wasn't communism. This isn't communism. We're just fighting for wages." And he said, he didn't say anything. Like no acknowledgement. He just turned and walked away. I mean, there was a gap here, you know, which we tried to bridge with our experiences that was never bridged, I guess, you know, in terms of these people. But there were many others that came around.
Okay. Now, let's go to 1968. And things, you're three years into the strike, and bottles are starting to be thrown. People are getting kind of pissed off. And Caesar says, "I got to do something about it."
That's right. I had had other opportunities. Well, let me just say, I had opportunities to see Caesar's evolving spirituality over the years that I was with him. To begin with, in 1965, when I joined him in Delano, he was still smoking. He was still having the occasional beer. He was drinking wine occasionally, you know. The first Christmas party, you know, I saw him drink a little bit too much. You know, he didn't get mean or anything, but you know. And he used to eat beans and tortillas and mole and meat. And he was a normal farm worker in that regard. As he began to evolve, as he began to cut back, as his diet changed, it was in conjunction with the growth of his spirituality that he had to tap into his spirituality in order to keep on going because of the long hours. And so, you know, the heavy meat brought him down. So he had to look for something else. He became a vegetarian. He became a fruitarian. They'd bring him a whole watermelon, half a watermelon, and that was his meal. You know, when everybody else was having chile verde, you know, he'd be over here eating half a watermelon, which is very, very unusual. But what also was unusual is not just what he was eating, but also what he was reliving within himself, and a lot of prayer. I mean, you had to respect him for praying, you know, frequently. sometimes when we were traveling, he's praying, meditating, things that were not typical of any farm worker anybody ever knew, and also carrying on a discourse about the value of spirituality. The whole Gandhian thing was very much a part of the early discourse when we were talking about the principles of the strike, because it wasn't all just tactics. A lot of it was tactics. But occasionally, when we talk about ideas, he's talking about the spirituality, about how important it is to do this and that. His back always gave him trouble. And there was one time when he was up on traction at home, and I went to see him again about some union business, and I had to meet with him in his bedroom, and his legs are up, you know. And I said, "How are you feeling, Caesar?" And he says, "Not too good," he says. "Maybe I've sinned too much." And I said, "That's an unusual thing to say." I mean, to take that upon himself, but talk about sin. I said, "This is a personal thing that's happening within him that is very, very deep." Now, that's way before the strike, you see. So when the strike started to happen, when the violence in the strike started to happen, he took it personally. He thought it was an affront. And there was a meeting that some of the early radicals from Berkeley wanted to have with him in 1967, because the union was about to enter the AFL-CIO, and these were radicals that had thought, you know, that the union would never join the AFL-CIO. That's a sellout, you know. But Caesar again was caught between the AFL-CIO and the Teamsters, and he explained this very carefully to us. He says, "I have no choice. I have to, and I'd rather join the AFL-CIO than the Teamsters." And but there were some people that felt, again, that this was a betrayal of the revolutionary promise of the early days. And as we were having this meeting, word came that a campesino down the street at one of the packing sheds had been run over by a truck. And so he just turned and looked at us, you know. And because part of the meeting had also involved complaints about the use of the Virgen de Guadalupe, about the masses, about the religiosity of the movement. And he was trying to explain, look, the spirit, the spirituality of it is part of the strength of what we're trying to do. It's personal, he said, but there are a lot of farm workers that believe in the Virgen de Guadalupe, and so we're tapping into their faith. And whereas a lot of the early radicals had no religious faith to speak of, you know, and so complained about the uses. So there were these schisms, you know, within the volunteers and the people in the union to begin with. There were people, actually, among the farm workers that were also weren't Catholic. They were Protestants. They didn't believe in the Virgen de Guadalupe. Epifanio Camacho, for instance, one of the early leaders of the strike, was this Protestant, and when we were planning the marches to Sacramento in 66, he got up and gave a big speech and says, "Look, I can follow Caesar and Dolores, I can follow the Union, but I can't follow the standard of Virgen de Guadalupe. That's not my faith," he's saying. "I don't believe in that. I'm not a Catholic, you know." And okay, you had to respect that. But nevertheless, the Virgen de Guadalupe led the march to Sacramento. More of a symbolic gesture, I guess, on the part of those that didn't believe than a religion, an element of faith. But the fact is that Caesar was more and more incorporating elements from the little pickup truck at the DiGiorgio Ranch that had the altar in the back to the use of priests. We saw priests begin to join the movement, you know, and beginning to change really their whole outfit, beginning to use the wee eagle, the farm worker's eagle, as part of their whole priestly outfit. And that certainly was in the background then. So eventually, when push came to shove in 1968, and things, in fact, were really starting to fall apart behind the scenes, that there were incidents of violence, there were beatings that were taking place. The union was trying to keep a cap on these because it was just bad press, you know. But some people in the union figured the way to handle a particularly bad labor contract was to beat the hell out of him, you know, and that happened. Or a particular scab, you know, that had been a little bit too cocky and out in the fields, you know, also got it. And there were also retaliations. You know, there were windows were being broken at the union office. There were people starting to set fires. I mean, it was really on the brink of something terrible. And this is why Caesar then decided to spring something personal. Again, working out of nothing. He had nothing really but himself. So he took it on upon himself, his example. He took it out on literally on his body by fasting. I think it's something that he had worked his way to philosophically over 3 or 4 years, you know, rethinking about it, how to apply this, or maybe a whole lifetime. But the fact is that by the spring of 1968, he was ready to go. And now by this time, El Teatro Campesino was in transition, and we had moved the theater to Del Rey, you know, which is 60 miles south of Delano, mainly to try to get a different perspective on the movement. I wanted to use the arts, I wanted to use the theater in a more direct, enduring way, you know, because it kept being pulled apart by the fury of the strike itself. So I wanted to be at a safe place so that we could come in when we were needed. And so someone called me and says, you know, there's something happening to Caesar. And I said, what's happening to Caesar? He says, well, come and find out. And I was kind of puzzled. I said, was he hurt? Well, come and find out. Has he been shot? What is it? Well, no, he's not been shot, but come and find out. And so I drove like a madman, you know, back to Delano. I found out he was out at the 40 acres. And so I went out there and went directly into the room where he was laying there, and he was fasting. And again, I understood. I never had problems understanding what Caesar was trying to do, but he felt the need to explain, you know, that this was the only way. And I saw the logic of it. Now, no one else had joined the ranks. It was just Caesar in this little room in the gas station on the 40 acres. There's no preparation, you understand, just Caesar just staying there. And the whole hoopla hadn't happened yet. It just started. And I said, well, what's your plan, Caesar? What are you going to do, you know? He says, well, I'm going to be here until the violence stops. And I said, well, what happens if it doesn't stop, you know? I mean, that was the first concern. And so people were a little puzzled, actually. The controversy at the time was that he was making too much of his own role in it, that he was making a saint of himself. And there was that kind of resentment, I think, within the movement. I understood it as, again, this grand gesture, you know, again, coming from him, from this character. And it seemed to be completely consistent with who he was. So I supported him, you know, joined him on as far as I could, you know, on the fast. And a lot of people started to fast and camp out there. I couldn't camp, you know, but I kept coming and going. And I saw it grow. And again, the more it grew, the more I smiled, because this is Caesar again pulling the rabbit out of the hat. This is Caesar again making a negative into a positive. You know, this negative that had been this growing violence suddenly becoming this strengthening nonviolence of the movement, this reaffirmation of a central principle of his organizing drive. And in that sense, I think it's a historic moment. Historic moment for Chicanos, a historic moment for farm workers, but a historic moment for the country, I think, for the whole country, because they were able to identify with Caesar as a result of what he was doing. And years later, 20 years later, in 1988, again, I was pulled into it, you know, with the second. He was 61 years old by then, and he was at it again. And again, I'll never forget how sharp he seemed to me. After all those weeks, you know, of fasting, he continued to remain very sharp in terms of what he wanted. Up to the last day when he stopped the strike, he still knew who was there and what was going to happen. He was in pain. His body was racked with pain. But he knew that it was going to turn things around. At least he wanted it to turn things around also the second time. It wasn't as successful the second time. But I think personally it was. Personally, it took his fast and his character to another level. Peter Jennings of ABC News declared him the person of the week that week. I'll never forget, because he had been fasting. And Bush Sr. thought he was going to be the man of the week that week, but it was Cesar Chavez. It was the first time we had seen Cesar in the national news for a long time, because people had begun to forget about the farm workers' movement. But he brought it all back. He had that kind of personal power. You know, when you can draw that kind of national attention to a cause through your own personal suffering, that's power.
Okay. Another key moment was the wonderful Great March.
Yeah.
What is your recollection of how that started and what happened along the way?
The March of Sacramento grew out of the need to do something during that first winter. What happened is that once the grapes were picked or were left on the vines, rotting on the vines, the fog came in the San Joaquin Valley, the San Joaquin Valley fog, and just blanketed everything. So the spirit has a tendency to die, you know, when it's cold and foggy and dark. and no one's picking in the fields. They aren't even, pruning vines. The leaves fall off, and then the pruning starts, and then the tying of the vines. All of that goes through a dead period. So let's say that the picking ends in the Delano grape strike. It ended in October, even November, because they were picking grapes late that year. But by November, they're gone. And then if there's a dead period, what do you do with a picket line? How do you keep your spirits up? We kept going out. Understand? We kept going out trying to spot other crews that were doing other things. But the spirit took a tumble there for a while. And so it required, the songs, the marches, that kind of stuff. And in February, after the tying of the vines, there's another period called El Invierno Chiquito, which is the little winter. So they have pruned, they have tied the vines up, and now we're just waiting for the vine. They get irrigating, and we're waiting for the vines to sprout. And that's and then there's a de-leafing. There's all these stages of the grape crop. But Invierno Chiquito is a little winter, is a time when farm workers really have nothing to do. And that's why they call it the little winter. It is in that period that we began early on in December to talk about what are we going to do when the little winter hits. And Caesar suggested immediately, let's march. He says, we've got to march. And again, he had thought this out. He had other things. He had led a very successful march back in Oxnard in 1958 when he had started organizing farm workers when he was part of the CSO. It was Braceros at that time. But he had led a short, very effective march that I think planted the seed for this long march. Now, what he was talking about this time was a long march, really, from... Originally, the idea was from Selma, California, to Sacramento. The reason that it started with that concept was because people like Marshall Gantz and some of the organizers of the Union had been in the Civil Rights Movement and had been in Mississippi the year before. And so they knew about the Selma to Montgomery march in Alabama. And so they said, why not march from Selma, California, to Sacramento? You're sort of a reflection of the Civil Rights Movement. And Caesar had liked that idea. But the more we discussed it, the more actually that it seemed silly. Why, the strike isn't in Selma, the strike is in Delano, another 50 miles back. So let's start in Delano and move all the way to Sacramento. In order to plan the march, Caesar always drew from ideas, as many ideas. He loved to get a group together, whether it was his family or whether it was the organizers, and just kind of brainstorm together, put it all in the pot, and let's see what we can keep out of these many ideas and organize them. So in order to do this, a number of us, perhaps a dozen to 20 people, maybe something like that, ended up going to Carpinteria, which is outside of Sacramento. It happens to be one of the places that was one of Caesar's haunts, when he was working with the CSO. And a friend had a house there, and so we all went there, the house that was on a cliff overlooking the ocean. A modest house, but, we all packed into this house. And we met there. We brainstormed over a weekend, and the idea was, what can we do to make this march as effective as possible? How do we organize it? What are the logistics of it? What do we need? And out of that weekend came conversations about, okay, we're going to need housing, we're going to need food, we're going to need some kind of communication system, to in advance, to send advance people out to set up other communities to receive us. We need to hit the media hard, we need to make it a media event. All the logistical questions came to bear, and we knew that there were a lot of questions that needed to be answered. But certainly the spirit of the piece was that we were going to not march straight up Highway 99, because that would be to evade or at least to not utilize the advantage, that we had by going through all these small towns where we could talk to farm workers. Also, it would be easier for us to take the back roads than to march all the way up Highway 99. The Highway Patrol was already saying, nope, you can't do that. As it turned out, we did do a stretch of Highway 99 at one point, but it would have been real hard for us to do it all. So we began to plan a march that took us all the way from Delano up to Ducor, up through Porterville, the back roads on the east side of the San Joaquin Valley, eventually all the way up through Fresno, Merced, Modesto, all the way up to Lodi, and then we crossed over to the west side, went over to Thornton and then eventually into Sacramento. Stockton was the crossover point, actually, and then up the west side up to Sacramento. All of that took a lot of planning from, I'd say, about December until March. We had 3 or 4 months. It was a lot of work to do. And that became the focus of all the organizers. We started to plan that. It was also decided at that time that that the Teatro Campesino would take charge of all the nightly rallies, you know, would pull up the banners, and the teatro would perform every night. And there'd be Caesar said he wanted a plan, so he asked me to draft a kind of plan. He gave me some points, some bullets, 5, 6, 7 bullets. And so I wrote El Plan de Deleno and eventually read it, you know, at the rallies. It was a declaration, really, of our principles, but most of it is Caesar's points. So I just structured them and used the Plan de Ayala that was released by Emiliano Zapata back in the Mexican Revolution as my model, and based the Plan de Leno on that. But it was decided by Caesar that it's in consultation with Father Kenny from Sacramento, the parish priest in Sacramento, that the theme of the march would be Peregrinación, Penitencia, Revolución, Pilgrimage, Penance, and Revolution. Now, you think about it, 1966, that's still pretty radical, a radical theme, you know, for anybody to go marching down the middle of California with Pilgrimage, Penance, and Revolution. And yet that was our rallying cry. And we sort of thought that people would join us, but it was a joyful event that thousands eventually joined us. You know, that first march started with about 75 people. It was really curious because the Delano police, you know, like, well, a lot of politicians and different people have no forethought about what their role is, but they helped us to launch us. And the way they did this is that they got brand new uniforms that day, tax squad uniforms with helmets and the visor and the shield and the belly club and the boots. And they came and they blocked the street leading out of the Union Office. We're at the outskirts of in the slum, basically, of Delano, you know, way out there where all the shacks are. They blocked the street. The tax squad stood out there so that we couldn't march. Well, all the news media were out there, and so that was a perfect image. Here's Delano, because they said we had no permit to march to town. And all we were doing is marching out of town. We were trying to get out of town. You know, they said you had to stay on the sidewalks. We said we have too many people. We had 100 people to start with. They said you have to stay on the sidewalk. Well, some kind of compromise was reached. We had to walk down one side of the street, one lane, okay, with the police leading us out of town. But this tax squad came out, and they got us on the national news that very first day. People were laughing about it because they were saying, you can't design this stuff. You can't predict it, but it happened. So eventually we did march to Delano and out, and there we go. We're on our way to Ducor. It was about 18 miles. None of us, very few of us, had ever marched 5 miles, much less 18 miles. We were green, man. And people weren't walking yet, you know. Bobby Kennedy had walked marched his 50 miles, you know, back in 1960, but we hadn't done that. But suddenly there we are on the way to Ducor, man, and after 5, 6, 7, 8 miles, it begins to wear on. Your feet start to hurt. You're saying I'm wearing the wrong shoes. Caesar was wearing boots. It was ridiculous. He was wearing work boots. And by the time we got to Ducor that late afternoon, that first day, we could barely walk, man. We could barely walk. We sat down. Our legs were paralyzed with exhaustion. We had to learn. We had to change shoes. We had to, you know, try a different tactic. But the thing is that eventually the body adjusts, right? But we were doing roughly 20 miles a day. And our time eventually went down from, I don't know how many hours it took us that first day, maybe 10 hours. And it was a whole afternoon and morning just to get there. But by the middle of the march, I mean, we were doing 20 miles in a clip, just it's like half day, and we're there, right? People could have done 40 miles. It was amazing, because the march went quickly. Now, along the way, what you're doing is you're rolling the tumbleweed. You know, what you do is a snowball that keeps on growing and growing and growing. In every town that we went through, experienced their own little revolution because the marchers are coming. It was the circus coming to town. It's the revival. It's Billy Graham. It's Cesar Chavez coming to town with all the news media following, right? And of course, we had the support trucks, you know, we had the portable toilets coming, you know. I mean, it was, in fact, a spectacle all of its own, with all the red flags and the Virgen de Guadalupe and the big cross, and it became an image that I think changed the landscape, you know, as we went through it. A personal thing for me is that we arrived to a little town called Cutler, which is southeast of Fresno, over by Orange Cove, you know, and you're going to Cutler or Rosie. Cutler, and the theater would go and set up the truck in advance, you know, and it so happens that that was the town where my wife lived, where she was raised, and some of the campesinos stayed at her parents' house that year, but that's when I met my wife, and we met on the march to Sacramento, and we've been married now for 36 years, you know, 37 years, so it stuck, you know what I'm saying, but we were united in the cause. But actually, I think a lot of that happened to a lot of people. They met things that influenced and changed their lives, you know, forever. The thing is that as we went along, we discovered that we were operating on this huge landscape, that it wasn't just about Delano or even Kern County or a part of Tulare County anymore, that we were dealing with a whole state and that we were confronting Governor Brown. Now, he wasn't there to greet us. He went to Palm Springs to play golf with Frank Sinatra, which was a cowardly thing for him to do, particularly being a Democrat of all things. But we were all there, you know, 10,000 people marched into Sacramento and took over the steps of the Capitol. And it seemed to me that we had arrived. You know, it seemed to me that, as I said once, that the air was full of the feeling that we were going to win.